please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to Educational HR Radio. Today, our guest is Carlos Alvarenga. He is the author of the book, The Rules of Persuasion, How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you on. We're excited about that. Let's talk about, first of all, the very basics. When we talk about persuasion, aren't there a lot of books on that already?
I don't think so. I think there are a lot of books that claim to talk about persuasion, but when you look behind the cover and look at the text, oftentimes they're about manipulation or about sort of human reactions to different things. Sometimes there are social science books, but I think the original book on persuasion, which was written a long time ago by a guy named Aristotle, is still kind of the definitive text in terms of human communication. And all I did with my book was try to update that and to bring it to a new audience, right, with modern examples and kind of up-to-date framework to people understand what was written a long time ago, which I stuck with is still the right way to think about this.
No, it's true. So if you want to just give me light right from the beginning, how do you define persuasion?
I'll take Aristotle's definition because I think it's still the best one. And he says, persuasion is a demonstration that something is true or appears to be true, period, right? That's the definition in a nutshell. And I think it's important because it has a couple of implications. Number one being that people don't persuade, the truth or the appearance of truth persuades. So as a communicator, your job is to have someone believe that something is true. Once that happens, assuming the audience is thinking rationally, the process kind of takes over and someone is persuaded.
So rationally, rational, that's a real big question, especially here in 2023. How are you? We're laughing a little here, but the truth is that how did you update that part of the book to look at how today we see things so inherently differently between humans?
I think on the surface, it seems that way, but the mechanism by which we're persuaded has stayed the same. In fact, in my book, I talk about ancient Chinese poetry. I talk about YouTube videos. I talk about philosophers and art and even in persuasion and paintings, right? And the mechanism that you see at work in all these messages is the same. Now, whether a particular formulation, as I call it, worked 100 years ago and doesn't work today, that's a different story, right? I would say persuasion is chemistry with language. And so there were formulas that worked in the days of the revolution that don't work anymore. But the fact that it's still being made with the same chemistry is true, I believe.
No, that's probably true. So I guess to telling the audience, tell them who you are. Tell them why you think that you are, smart enough, wonderful enough to write this book.
So I'll start with a little bit of an arc about my career. I started as a journalist in Latin America after my studies and was hired to ghostwrite a book for someone. And I wrote the book. That got me in a very roundabout way into management consulting, where I spent a long career and eventually became a managing director at Accenture. After that, a principal at Ernst & Young. So I had a typical consulting career during which I also taught. I was an adjunct professor at the Smith School of Business, University of Maryland. And looking back at my career, what I realized that a skill I used throughout that career was to persuade someone or a company, right, to hire our firm. And I was pretty good at that, which is why I was successful. When I left consulting, I joined a private executive group, and I had a chance to see hundreds of really phenomenal communicators up close. And these included heads of state, movie actors, right, venture cap people, authors. And so I spent 3 years in a front row seat, literally in a front row seat, watching some of the world's best communicators. When I stopped doing that and decided to write my first book, I would naturally came back to this question of why is someone believed and why is someone not believed? What makes someone trustworthy, and why does their message work in this setting, but it doesn't work in other settings? At the same time, I started, as part of my research effort, I started coaching. So I began to coach leaders, especially of nonprofits who are starting or struggling with communication. And as I started the coaching process, I realized that a fundamental problem was that people have never learned persuasion. In other words, the things that I'd read a long time ago and read all the time are not part of the typical curriculum. We don't learn how to be persuasive in grammar school or typically in college or an MBA school. So it's kind of an esoteric topic for specialists. And so, which is, I found a very interesting thing, because most professional jobs require persuasion to succeed, and yet we never study it. So I thought it was a kind of a strange thing that it's so critical to succeeding in our lives. And yet at no point do we stop and say, what is this task or this skill that I'm supposed to master? And where do I understand it? And how do I understand it? And so the goal of the book was to take a lot of very specialized knowledge and to make it accessible to a modern audience using modern examples and in a way that I thought people would understand.
It's interesting you talk about skills that are not necessarily taught in school, or at least things that we probably should. I almost would argue almost all soft skills, including any emotional intelligence, is something that is very rarely taught in actual schools. It's assumed a lot.
Yeah, but here's where I push back a bit, because I argue that persuasion is not a soft skill. It is a very concrete way in which things work. And it's very predictable, a lot more predictable, let's say, that some things which are supposed to be, you know, hard, quote unquote, which really aren't. I spend a lot of time working in consulting and forecasting. I can tell you that forecasts for business are one of the softest things in the world. Persuasion is much more of a concrete subject to me today than working with forecasting, let's say, for retail businesses was when I was a consultant. So I think that we think of it as soft because we've never been taught it. It was, for example, imagine that you didn't know that there were such things at music schools, and you heard somebody whistling a tune, or you heard somebody being a good musician. You would think, boy, that's a great skill that this person has. They're making music. That's nice. Too bad I wasn't born with it, right? Then one day you find out, oh, wait, there's a thing called, you know, Juilliard. And suddenly it becomes a different perspective, right? And I think the same thing happens here, because persuasion, which used to be taught, was taught for thousands of years, dropped out of the curriculum after World War II. We've come to think of it as an amorphous skill, but I argue in the book that it isn't. It works with very specific rules and very predictable outcomes.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. Of course, I'm your host, David Chulo, Educational HR Radio. Our guest today is Carlos Alvarenga, and he is talking about his book, The Rules of Persuasion, How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive. You know, it's interesting. Today's day and age, there are a lot in the news. There are a lot in the political world that talk about social media. Yeah. And social media, they say, persuades, influences, and can really adapt people's thinking. What's your thoughts on that? And did you include this as part of your book?
There is. When I was drawing up the table of contents of the book, my publisher said, if you're right about Aristotle, if you're right about persuasion being this universal mechanism, right, then we should see it at work on Twitter and Instagram. And I thought it's an interesting question. So there's a chapter in the book that's persuasion and technology platforms. So I look at Wikipedia, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And what you find is that the same mechanisms are at play there, right? Each platform has a dominant persuasion ethic. So for example, YouTube tends to be driven by character or personality. It is the host of the channel, for the most part, that tends to drive the persuasive effect. Instagram, for example, like TikTok, tends to be emotion. So people make emotional claims, emotional statements. It's photography typically, right? So video tends to run towards emotional presentations. You don't really make argument in video for the most part, because those platforms work with very, very short video. So you make an impression, there's an emotional reaction, Twitter, now X, right, ran through debate and argument, right? So that because it was built really by journalists, and that they created the dominant ethics of X, right? It was a platform for arguing and fighting. And so you see that what these technologies do is they simplify, right? And they are dominated by, typically speaking, by one mode. That doesn't mean that every message on Instagram is an emotional message. It just means that that's the dominant mechanism by which you gain influence and followers on a platform like Instagram, or and TikTok is sort of the same.
So when and obviously that's not something that necessarily is shared on the platform. They don't say we are influenced by this, right, or whatever, that part of it. So how does somebody identify a platform or a format? Is there any way to kind of look at it and say this? I mean, look, we have left, right, we have center, we have all different ways that people identify. But from a persuasion perspective, if we're talking about the rules, how does someone identify a platform or a format in which they will understand that this is trying to persuade me in a direction?
If you do what I did in the book, which is to look at the kinds of messages that get the most traction on the platform, right? What are the top five tweets, the top five videos? And you said the algorithms are designed to promote and to reinforce the persuasion, let's say, mechanism of the platform. It's not that complicated. One should look at what the algorithms promote to see what it is that is driving this platform, right? If what you see is that the algorithms continually show people emotional messages and then reactions to emotional messages, then you have a pretty good sense that, listen, this platform is being driven by an emotional persuasion algorithm. Likewise, if what you get pushed up is arguments, debates, insults, right, conflict, then you say, okay, the platform likes conflict. And so it's going to feed me conflict as long as I react to it. And the platforms, on the one hand, they're very sophisticated, but on the other hand, they're very simple, right? They're easy to predict. Once you understand the dominant persuasion logic of the platform, which kinds of messages will do well and which kind of messages won't do well. A reasoned, calm argument is going to get you very far in X, right? X works by you pick a fight with somebody famous, hopefully they respond, which increases your ability to argue. And now you can pick a fight with somebody even more famous, right? And you kind of climb the fame ladder on X by arguing your way from the bottom to the top. And it can happen quickly, it can happen over time. So the same thing on emotional platforms like Instagram, right? You create an emotional message, people react to it, it gets circulated, and now your ability to affect emotion in people goes up, and that cycle gets repeated as you gain more influence and more followers.
How does this feed basic human behavior? You know, in other words, we all have certain behaviors that we do as humans. Mm-hmm. And why is persuasion such a coveted thing?
I think I say in my book that it's because we like our truths and we want others to share them. Right. And I say in the book that, yes, persuasion can be about selling or about negotiating. That's great. Right. That's an application of the rules. But fundamentally, deep down inside, I think it's human nature to have others believe we believe. For example, if you watch a movie, let's say you love Goodfellas and you think it's just the best movie ever made, there's just this human trait that you want other people, right, to think Goodfellas is a great movie. And people argue and say, no, but it's the best. And this is Scorsese at his finest and everything else, right? And so there's just this innate human nature to want others to believe what we believe. And I think that's the origin of what makes persuasion this universal human trait.
So when you were writing this book, as we head into the last minute of this segment, give me two reasons why somebody should buy it.
I think most people, like I said earlier, don't understand what persuasion is because they've never studied it. And this book will explain to you what it is. And second, it is a great way to understand messages coming to you, right? It is a way for you to become a better filter of what arrives in your mental inbox and say, okay, what is being used on me? What formulation is this message carry? And you become a much better critic at the same time as you become a much better communicator.
Well, we're going to talk about coercion versus persuasion in the next segment. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, a news talk, WLOB 100.5 FM and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Don't know where to go.
Take it to Moody's.
You want to get on with your life, get on with the show.
Take it to Moody's.
Good people you can trust,
and it won't be a fuss.
Take it to Moody's. Collision Centers.
M-O-O-D-Y.
Your kid was talking on the cell phone, drove right through your own home. Sitting in the parking lot, maybe you get hit a lot. Driving through the green light, suddenly your side swipe. Put it in reverse, but it turned out that it was first.
Take it to Moody's. Take it to Moody's. Collision Centers.
As the list of compliance challenges for businesses continues to grow, it's time to think about your payroll vendor as someone that can do more than just pay your employees. I'm Chris Clough, president of Paper Trails. We're a team of fun and local experts purveying convenient, high-tech payroll and compliance services across New England. Whether your business is struggling to stay compliant with an earned paid leave law, you're worrying about retirement savings programs, or you have questions about your state's paid family medical leave, Paper Trails has the team and tools necessary to allow you to handle the work while we handle the paperwork. To learn more about Paper Trails and how we can help your business, visit papertrails.com/HR Power Hour.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Beryl-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and today we're talking about the rules of persuasion, how the world's greatest communicators convince, inspire, lead, and sometimes deceive. This book came out right in August 7th, 2023. Is that correct? Just came out, hot off the presses, as they say.
Exactly.
This is your first, second, third book?
This is the first nonfiction book. It's my second book, first nonfiction.
Oh, that's right. You had the one you ghost wrote too as well, correct?
Yeah, I'm not even counting that one. Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. And what was the previous book?
It is a novel about Italy, which is in submission right now. So it hopefully will be out next year.
Hey, well, since I love Italy and Italian, I will go with that. I can't wait to listen to it. So again, we're talking with Carlos Alvarenga, and he is the author of the book, The Rules of Persuasion. So in the previous segment, we kind of teased at the end that we would talk about persuasion versus coercion. So let's start with a very basic definition. What is the difference? How does it work together? Tell us about this, and then we'll get into the management, leadership, and HR implications.
Well, we're there now because this is a fundamental topic in leadership, right? And persuasion is getting someone to do something willingly. Coercion is when someone does something unwillingly. And in some cases, the distinction is very clear. In leadership, in business and management, it's often not so clear. And I'll give you an example. Let's say your boss says, I just finished a book, business book. I think it's great. I think this is how we should organize ourselves. I want you to read this book. Okay. Mm-hmm. You start to read the book. You don't agree the book is that great. In fact, you think it's kind of soft or weak. What are you going to say? If you come back and say, you know, I agree, David, this book was amazing. Let's reorganize around the book set. Are you persuaded or are you coerced? Right. And so there, I say to leaders sometimes, there's a simple test you can apply mentally to this question. That is, imagine you left the organization tomorrow. Would your ideas, would your programs, would your initiatives survive? Would they continue? If they would, you've probably persuaded people they're good things. If your ideas die with you, if they leave with you, right, then you may have operated under the guise of coercion. People are doing it because they think they have to. And this is a problem because I talk about in the book that one of the There are sort of 21 elements, I say, in the book that make up kind of what I call the periodic table of persuasion, right? All these formulations are made, messages are made from these 21 things. One of the elements is called status, right? And so status is a very tricky thing. And we can be persuaded by status. Sometimes we're persuaded by the reversal of status when the Pope washes someone's feet. That is the reversal of status, right? He humbles himself, and we find that a moving moment because we see someone of very, very high status who assumes the role of a servant to the human being. And it's an emotional, powerful thing. And so if you get that right, it's wonderful. If you get it wrong, you wind up affecting people in ways that you may not have intended, unknowingly unconscious of how the status you bring to a conversation is affecting your audience.
You talked about this persuasion periodic table, and you know, it's kind of sounds like chemistry. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and thinking through, you know, Aristotle in his book says something which has been said many, many times and written about thousands of times. And he says only three things persuade, and that is the character of the speaker, the arguments presented, and the emotion that the audience feels while the speaker is communicating. And that's wonderful. But the problem is that Aristotle's book was not meant to be read by the public. It was either, we don't know exactly what it was. It was either his private notebook or a kind of student guide, right? So he doesn't really explain what he means by these three things. So you hear them called ethos, pathos, logos sometimes. So right, for me, the question, well, what do you really mean by that? And so as I studied and thought about my experience, I came to this frame that says, if you think about someone's character, there are sort of seven pieces that make up what we think about someone when it comes to persuasion. The same thing with argument and the same thing with emotion. And so to make it the process or the framework understandable, I just said, my wife's a scientist, and she said, well, it's kind of like the periodic table. I said, yeah, it is. Because if you take these 21 things, a good language chemist, a good persuasion chemist mixes them up, right? And is able to make a message that persuades with these 21 elements. And as I looked at all the poetry and plays and art and language, I could find these 20, some combination, right, of these 21 things at play in every one of these messages, which I thought was really interesting.
That is interesting. And, you know, as we talk about this a little more, it's one of those questions I have is it just these 21 things just come to you? Are they so obvious? Explain a little bit about the actual use of them. Because, you know, you're talking about persuasion in a record time sometimes.
Well, what happens is that most people have a kind of natural tendency to one of these three things, right? Or a couple of these three things. For example, there are people who are comfortable speaking about themselves, which means that they're going to gravitate towards the character elements, right? As a persuasive formulation. There are people who are more logical and they like statistics and data. This is an unusual group because some people are not like this, but there are people who are. And so they will gravitate to argument. Then there are people who are very good at generating emotion in others. They make you feel good, or they make you feel excited or inspired, right? And so their dominant sort of formulation is the elements of emotion. And so what happens is most people use a combination, but I find that professional communities especially tend to gravitate to one of the three categories, right? And one of the three sort of dominates. And when I do coaching, we look at film a lot. And so film is very easy to show somebody, here is the formula, now watch the next 2 minutes, and then you see each element pop up during the clip, and you realize, yeah, I get it now, right? We're watching Tom Cruise, I talk about all the time, with A Few Good Men, right? He's interrogating Jack Nicholson because he wants Nicholson to confess. He has no evidence, he has no witnesses, right? The only thing he has is persuading Nicholson to admit he ordered this attack on this young Marine. And so it's a really good example of argument. I show people the opening scene of Patton, or the first 90 seconds. We hear no words. Scheffner, who's the director, shows us only close-ups of Patton, his hands, his head, his helmet, his uniform, right? It's all about the character of the soldier standing before us. So once you, back to what we sort of in the last segment, once you become aware of the elements, you see them at work all around you.
And of course, we're talking about the rules of persuasion, how the world's greatest communicators convince, inspire, lead, and sometimes deceive. It's out on paperback as of August 7th, 2023. go grab a copy. Amazon, I'm assuming, is the right
Amazon,
place.
Amazon, Kindle, audiobooks. It's on all the formats available.
Any place you want to get a book, you're there.
Buy, read, listen to. I did the narration for the audio, so I apologize in advance for anyone who doesn't like the voice on the audio recording. That's me. So
I'm sure it's fine. It's okay. So, you know, one of the things that when I think about leaders today, and there's a lot of talk about individualism, each person wants to receive communication in an individualistic manner. They want to receive it based on tone, inflection, body language, all the different components of communication. And talking about all the different formulas you have within the book and so forth, what does a leader really need to know about that person, that individual that works with them, that's under them, that or a peer that's beside them, or even managing up, as we know, or leading up to their senior leaders? What do they need to know to be able to properly use the rules of persuasion?
I think two things, David. One is I talk about what I call foundation truth. And what does that mean? It means that for your formula to work, certain things must be true. And I talk about Nike, for example. Nike, to my knowledge, has never run an ad explaining why exercise is good. It assumes you believe that. The ads are for why you should exercise with Nike gear, right? So a foundational truth is exercise is good for you. Let's move on from that and talk about Nike, right? What I find that oftentimes when leaders struggle is they haven't taken a step back, or they make assumptions about foundational truth that just aren't true. Like they're a trusted source of information, or people are happy to receive a message. And so if it's not working, take a step back and say, okay, what am I assuming that something is true when it maybe it isn't? And if so, you have to address that doubt, right? Or that missing truth before you deliver a message. The other thing is to understand the nature of your audience, right? The audiences vary just the way speakers do. And so I talk about audiences in one of the chapter, but I think understanding how the rules work as a communicator also makes you a good judge of audiences, right? Because audiences operate in the same way. They're reciprocal. There's a kind of respect that goes when you communicate to them and say, I trust your judgment. I trust that you're going to hear me and respond to me. But what I find is too often communicators are obsessed or focus on the message only and don't say, okay, what makes this audience work? What formulations have worked with them in the past? Is my formulation consistent with what works? And if not, why am I changing it? And do I know that the way I speak is really going to work? And I'll give you a really good example. I work with someone who love data, statistics, right? Brilliant executive in fashion, but she was probably the least effective member of the C-suite in the company she worked at. And why? Because most people have a hard time with argument. They are not trained to follow it. It's hard to put together correctly, right? And so I mentioned my wife's a scientist. I've seen her give talks, and it's a very specialized skill to be able to give, to persuade, and to be persuaded by science and statistics. That's not the average person. In fact, they say the more you love logic and argument and proofs, the farther you away from persuading the average person. And so in her case, what we did was to say, okay, can you deliver the same information in a story? Can you use your own character? Can you create narratives? Not that we're going to eliminate the PowerPoint slides that have statistics and data, but we're going to complement that, give people time to absorb. It takes time to process this, right? For lots of reasons I talk about in the book. And so just by reconfiguring a primarily data-driven or argument-driven message to one that includes narrative or character stories, suddenly your effectiveness, your persuasiveness goes way up. And all you did was change which elements you use in the formulation, right? The message is the same, but it's delivered a little bit differently. And oftentimes that's the difference between being successful or not being successful.
Can a leader in their quest to be successful know when they're being quote unquote coerced or conned?
I think people do, because I talk about certain emotion having a feeling of authenticity or a sense of manipulation. We're pretty good judges when we're thinking correctly, right? And especially in professional settings, when someone is trying to sort of game us, when someone is not delivering the entire message. And what happens is that we become defensive, right? The more someone does that, the more we disengage. And one thing I talk about in the book, which I hadn't seen in any of the book, I could be wrong, maybe it's out there, but I didn't see it, was what exactly is persuasion? In other words, if persuasion is chemistry, then what is the formula? What is the reaction? And I in the book, I talk about how we go through sort of four states, right? There's the, I call it pre-audience. So you're walking in the hall of the company, you're thinking about game or something like that, and you're like a computer on screensaver, right? You're waiting to wake up. Suddenly somebody stops you and starts to and says, let's talk. You have a decision to make. Do I engage with you or do I not? Okay. I could say, not now, I'm busy. Or I could say, okay, I'm going to stop and I'm going to listen to you. Now you've engaged, right? As you engage, what happens is that if I'm going to be persuasive, my formulation brings an idea to life. The more you engage, the more energy you give it. My formula gives it energy. Your attention and mind interaction gives it energy. Eventually, if I succeed, there's enough energy is released that it's the idea comes to life. Suddenly you see it. We have to do something, right? The last step is adherence. In other words, is it sticky? Do you still believe this a day or two later, right? And so this is the critical thing is when we feel that someone isn't being honest, we hold back our energy, right? Which means the message never comes to life, which means we're not persuaded.
You know, it's very interesting. So many components to this in regards to, it's simple. It's actually extremely simple to talk about, but it's not so simple to digest, understand, and really recognize it sometimes, or as simple as it should be sometimes, I would say, in terms of that aspect.
I think it seems that way in the beginning because it's something new, right? We never think about this. Once, in my experience, once I coach someone and once they, it kind of the light bulb goes on and it clicks that, okay, this is how it works, then you cannot not see it this way. Suddenly you realize, yeah, this is emotion. This is character. The person is giving me this particular formulation. And so it's just practice.
Do you think there's an element of being inquisitive or being, you know, maybe seeing the glass half empty sometimes to be able to believe?
I think it's about understanding what is the communicator trying to get me to believe, right? And so I think of me as a critic of this, right? I listen to a message and I think, okay, how is the message being delivered? What's the chemistry? But also, what's it effect on me if I believe it? What do they want me to do or agree with or believe or take some kind of action? So I think what's the curiosity comes. And not just what are they saying, but how are they saying it?
And that makes sense. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, 100.5 FM and podcasts on all major podcast channels. We will be right back. Educational HR Radio is critical to your organization's success, and our sponsors understand the value this program brings to owners, C-suite professionals, and the HR community. We are honored to thank our sponsors for their support and contributions to this program. We thank the law firms of Verrill, Jackson Lewis, and Sheehan Finney, along with our partners, Paper Trails and Strategic HR. Want to be the next sponsor of the HR Power Hour? Text 603-303-6124 and say HR Power Hour sponsor.
Hi, I'm Susan McVetty.
And I'm Pete McVetty from McVetty's Hearth and Home.
Is there a sale going on at the store right now?
No.
No Hearthstone, Quadrifier, Mendota, Wittes, Blaze King, or Morso sale?
No.
No Yodel, Vermont Castings, or Regency? Oh, there's always a Regency sale.
No.
You're telling me that out of the gazillions of wood, gas, and pellet stoves that we carry, there's not a single sale going on?
Nope.
Oh, what about patio furniture, awnings, grills, smokers, and aluminum docks?
No, just because there isn't a big sale going on doesn't mean that we're not having great deals and still doing free estimates for anyone needing a heating appliance.
Oh, well, good. Just let me know when we're having another sale.
Okay, there's always a bargain to be had if you are looking for one. and we don't need a new heating appliance.
Well, maybe my sister needs one, or my friend, or your sister.
Stop by McVetty's Hearth and Home at 893 Route 1 in Yarmouth, or check out our website at stovesofmaine.com for the latest information, including our sales.
Really? I have to check out the website? Really? And I can't believe Regency isn't having a sale.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
With Zillow, you're not just looking for a house. You're looking for the bathroom where you'll give your kids shampoo mohawks. The bonus room you'll turn into a gym and work out in every single day, starting tomorrow. You're looking for hardwood floors worthy of your signature dance move, the glitchy robot.
You're not just looking for a house. You're looking for a place for your life to happen. And whether buying or renting, Zillow makes it easy with simple smart search features, photos, video walkthroughs, and more. Zillow, find your way home.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to Educational HR Radio. Today, our guest is the one, the only, Carlos Alvarenga. And today, we're talking about the rules of persuasion, how the world's greatest communicators convince, inspire, lead, and sometimes deceive. From the book, you provide a lot of case studies. As a matter of fact, you do some fun ones on Plato, Mao, and Muhammad. Is Kevin Costner?
That's right. And so the question is, there in the first part of the book, I look at character, argument, emotion. Then I have a chapter which looks at five examples of really master communicators putting all the elements to work, right? And the first one is Plato and the dialogues. And it ends with a video from Kevin Costner at the eulogy, giving eulogy for Whitney Houston, which I think is one of the finest modern American rhetorical examples you can study, right? Costner didn't want to speak about Whitney Houston after she died. And it was her family that convinced to come to the ceremony, the funeral, and deliver the eulogy. And he's got an interesting assignment, right? He knew her. They weren't very good friends, but it's in a Black, from a probably Black religious institution. He's a famous white Hollywood actor. And so, but within the first minute, his ability to connect himself, because he grew up in a Baptist church as Houston did, that use of that history, that joint origin, which united the two of them when they worked together on The Bodyguard, completely wins over the audience in that first opening part of his speech. And it's a beautiful example of a phenomenal communicator with great delivery skills, right, David? Because, of course, it's Kevin Costner.
Yes, yeah.
Everything comes together in this video. And I think it's a great training video of someone operating with the rules at the highest possible level. So I think it's a wonderful example. But I'll give you one a little bit more sort of down to earth, perhaps, and that is my very first client, right? So the very first person I ever coached is the head of an international relief organization, right? They go when there's earthquakes and tsunamis, his organization comes in and provides healthcare for the victims. And so a very senior elder statesman in his 70s, very distinguished person. And his charge to me was, look, I'm not a very engaging person. I don't feel like I'm connecting as well as I could. And he wasn't about to start telling jokes or become this sort of a liar. I mean, he's a serious person with a serious job. And as we looked at his character, the arguments he made, and the emotion he wanted the audience to feel, I realized that, as is often the case, his character was completely out of the speech. He didn't talk about himself at all. He talked about the statistics and facts about the people they help, which is important, but it wasn't connecting as well as it could. And he hadn't thought about, what do I want you to feel, right, when you hear me? So I said to him, why are you here? Why do you have this job? He said, well, because I was a young aid worker in disaster zone, and I heard this group of people speaking, and I went to talk to them, and I connected with them. And I thought what they were doing was so great. And the attitude they had in this very difficult moment was to help these people. And I was just became overwhelmed emotionally to be part of this group. 20 years later, I'm the chairman and CEO, and I've been here ever since. And I said, well, why don't you let people see that? Why don't you pause for a moment before you ask for donation support and tell them what you just told me? And for 60 seconds, be vulnerable. Let the pride and the love you have for this institution come out in front of the audience. Let them feel the depth of the commitment you have to this cause. And I think because you're so serious, and because up to now, you've been very strictly controlled, a moment where you not lose control, but just show some emotion will be extremely powerful. So of the 20-minute speech, use 1 minute to talk about yourself and to share the feeling that you have for the group that you lead. He did that and came back and said, it was amazing. It was a completely different reaction. It was the best speech I've ever given. And all we really did was change two or three things. So sometimes it's not a big change, right, David? It's simply the fact that if you're very serious, show some humanity, show some emotion. If you're very emotional, pause for a second. Sometimes the reversal, right, of what is our dominant formula is what stops the audience cold and makes someone lean into what you're saying.
If somebody is thinking to themselves, well, you know, I've heard a lot about persuasion, and, you know, I'm interested in the fact that maybe I could be more persuasive. Is there, you know, ways that they can practice this? You talk about in the book about techniques, how they can build their skills, how they can work through that process. Is that detailed in the book?
It is. And I'd say there are two things that I'll talk about here. One is everyone I coach, I ask them to keep what I call a persuasion journal, which is start to write down either literally, physically, or in your mind, start to note the messages you receive, right? Great musicians listen to a lot of music. Great writers read a lot. And so if you're going to be a good communicator, listen to messages and say, what was at work? When I heard this commercial, this scene in the movie, this person talking to me at work, my boss, my board, my peers, right? So that's one thing. The other is think of persuasion as, imagine whenever you communicate, you have three dials. One is called your character, one is called argument, one is called emotion. And they go from 0 to 10. Where did you set the dial? And where are you going to set the dial? Are you going to try to affect me through emotion, through a story about yourself, through facts and figures? And then see if you can get better and better at tweaking the dial. At first, the dials will seem like they're on and off, but you're like, oh no, they have little clicks in them. And you'll wind up down the road, and you know, there's 10 clicks and be able to adjust them. And so you just get better at fine tuning the dials as you practice.
Can you overshoot the mark? Can you do too much? Can you be too emotional or too reverse of who you are? Does it become out inauthentic?
It can, and it came out inauthentic or in different ways, right? I got a call to coach someone who had been at Davos. And this young man, amazing young man who had been a refugee his whole life from Somalia, he lived in a camp, a UN camp, and he had been sent to the World Economic Forum to speak about refugees. When he got there, he was coached by someone who helped him with body position and how to hold the mic and how to, you know, mechanics, right? But they didn't talk about what he was going to say. The moment he started speaking, and I saw the video, an anger overwhelmed him. He was angry, rightly so, by the way. He felt that the world doesn't care about us, and all the injustices and tragedies of his life took over his message. And so I explained to him, I understand why that happened, but the anger was so overwhelming that the audience couldn't connect with you because what they saw was someone who was suffering, right? And we're not persuaded by that necessarily. We may feel bad, but it isn't typically a persuasion strategy. If you can't control your anger, the anger will control you. And so we worked successfully to have him communicate about himself and what he wanted while keeping the anger under control, right? And so that was a case of lowering a genuine emotional content. What's more, that's less usual than what I see, which is, I talk about in the book, the difference between emotion and sentiment. You know, a Hallmark card is sentimental. What does that mean? It means that the person who wrote it doesn't know what it's going to be used for, so it's a completely artificial creation. The reason we write things in the card is because we want to add emotion to sentiment. We want to convert a sentimental little poem into an emotional statement because we think of emotion as earned. When someone who's been married for 30 years says, I love you, thank you for being my partner in my life, that's an emotional statement, which is superimposed onto sentimental, you're the best thing that ever happened to me, in the card. So what happens is that people sometimes mistake sentiment for emotion and they try to fake it. And this happens a lot in business. Somebody comes and goes, aren't you excited to be here? No, you're not. Maybe you are because you get paid a lot. Most people in the audience aren't. And so why would you claim that we're excited if when you take a step back, you realize we're not, okay? So the moment you get into that kind of language, right, then we have an issue. So take a step back. Think about real and genuine feelings, and you're usually in a much better place.
That's awesome. We're going to wrap it up here on the last segment of the HR Power Hour. Right after this, you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk, WLOB 100.5 FM, and podcasts on all major podcast channels. We'll be right back.
As the list of compliance challenges for businesses continues to grow, it's time to think about your payroll vendor as someone that can do more than just pay your employees. I'm Chris Clef, president of Paper Trails. We're a team of fun and local experts purveying convenient, high-tech payroll and compliance services across New England. Whether your business is struggling to stay compliant with an earned paid leave law, you're worrying about retirement savings programs, or you have questions about your state's paid family medical leave, Paper Trails has the team and tools necessary to allow you to handle the work while we handle the paperwork. To learn more about Paper Trails and how we can help your business, visit papertrails.com/HRPowerHour.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo. And of course, you're listening to Educational HR Radio. Our guest today has a great book out, which I highly recommend that you go out and buy. It's called The Rules of Persuasion, How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive. And of course, we're talking with Carlos Alvarenga, and he's the author of this great book. You know, Carlos, as we wrap this up, when the audience is thinking, have I ever wondered what makes someone convincing or why some messages persuade when others do not? When the audience thinks about, have you ever struggled with how to create a persuasive message, story, or presentation? And when the audience thinks, do you want to understand how persuasion can be used to corrupt or achieve dangerous ends? This is all from Amazon.
Right.
How does this book help people understand, take them to the end to get them to pick up the phone, go online, and order this book?
The most important way is that it changes, I hope, your perception of what persuasion is from something which you're either born with, or it's a soft skill, or something which is sort of, you kind of land there in some way, to a skill that you can acquire. There are, start with the three methods, start with the elements that are there, start with the examples, and start to think about how these rules operate in your own messaging to your colleagues and to your team and to your leaders. And by giving you a roadmap to follow, which the book does, by breaking down the pieces of that make up persuasion and showing you step by step how this stuff works, then that gives you the ability then to say, to become what I call more, you know, to use the word intentional, right? As you deliver a message, change it. And so one last case study, and that was because I just heard from a reader, a friend of my wife read the book. He works with startups who are trying to get regulatory approval for new products. And he had had a client that had a hard time. They'd done three meetings, didn't go anywhere. He read the book. He said, you know what? I'm going to tell them an emotional story about why the founders quit at this company. And we're not going to talk about the science for this next meeting. And they did. And he said, he called me and he goes, it was exactly as you predicted. It was a wonderful meeting. We're going to get approval. Everything changed this one conversation. It's only because I read the book. And I think that what the book does is give you a way to put process and structure on something that today may seem as an undefined thing.
Carlos, let's wrap this up. Tell them about where they can reach you. Tell us a little bit about Persuasion Lab, and we'll wrap up the show for today.
Sure. So Persuasion Lab is a project that's going to kick off in January. I've heard from many readers who want to keep studying or learning. I continue to research this topic, and I'm always coming across new information and new cases. So you can reach out to me at calvarenga@persuasionlab.org. And if you're interested because you read the book or because you would like to know more, then I can tell you about how to join Persuasion Lab and be part of this community that continues to study this fascinating topic.
I got to thank you so much for being a guest today. You have done a great job explaining the rules of persuasion in the book. And we wish you the best of luck with the sales of your book.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we are podcast on all major podcast channels.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.